This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Even though a great deal of technology has affected the way that we farm, they still really have to follow the rhythm of the land and adjust their behavior accordingly. And that is how we get our food in this country. It's really pretty extraordinary to think about it. And I will also say one of the things that does make the United States amazing is that it can sustain its population. We do create enough calories for people to consume, which is really pretty remarkable.
Anyone who's gone to the grocery store during the COVID-19 health crisis must have wondered to themselves at some point why there was no toilet paper, milk, or flour all of a sudden. It's an important reminder that most of us have very little idea how things go from being planted in the ground to being stocked on our shelves. On this week's Sea Change Radio, we speak to Marie Mutsky-Monkett, an author whose family owns a wheat farm in Nebraska. Her new book, American Harvest, takes us inside the world of wheat harvesting. We get a glimpse into the lives of the farmers she met while researching her book, discuss how those in the industry are coping with the pandemic, and take a closer look at the agricultural industry's practices. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Marie Mutsky-Monkett. Her latest book is called American Harvest. Marie, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is your third book. The first one was a novel called Picking Bones from Ash, and the second one was Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye. That was a book in the wake of the tsunami. This is a timely book. Obviously, you did not think that we would be in a global health crisis, but we are all looking at food in a different way. Why don't you kind of give us a snapshot of what the thesis of American Harvest is, and then I want to dive into how it's relevant to what we're struggling with right now.
Well, I guess in terms of thesis, it's a couple things. It is a road trip from Texas all the way to Idaho, but it was born because my American family, my father's American, my mother's Japanese, but my father's family has always had a wheat farm in the panhandle of Nebraska. And maybe 15 years ago, I was at wheat harvest with him in July, and I had flown out from New York City, and I was sitting in the Quonset with some of the men in the family. And I thought, why is it that all of us here who live in cities believe in evolution and believe in science? Science was a big thing in my family. And we happily farm with GMOs. And yet I have, but the farmers on the ground here are devout Christian who also farm with GMO technology. But my friends in the city, who I see most of the time, believe in evolution, don't have any time for creationism, but want organic food. This felt like a contradiction. So you have the Christian farmers who believe in creationism and employ GMO technology, people in the city who primarily want organic food and believe in evolution. And it felt like a discrepancy, and I didn't know why this existed. And so I started to talk to farmers. Every time I was with a farmer, I would ask this question. And finally, Eric Wolgamuth, who has been our family wheat harvester for 30 years, said to me, you know, this is not really a question about religion or about science. You're asking about the divide, the cultural divide. And so I went on the road with him through the American heartland, and kind of examined where I was, always with this question in the back of my mind, and that road trip yielded the book that you have there.
And how has the COVID-19 crisis made you think of what you just went through in researching and writing this book in a different light?
Oh gosh, so many things. I mean, first of all, I was on the road with a team of harvesters, all of whom were devout Christians, some of whom we would consider evangelical Christians. So we went to church every single Sunday. And pretty early on, I realized that a number of them were very well versed in the book of Revelation and with the idea of an apocalypse. And we would periodically talk about an apocalypse. And the way that the apocalypse was brought up was, can you imagine what will happen if there's suddenly a big worldwide disaster and people in the city realize how dependent they are on us? And then they would imagine all of the things that would happen, all of the things that would go wrong, how would they behave, etc. But it was sort of this imaginary conversation or this imaginary space that we would inhabit that was greatly informed by the book of Revelation. And I didn't really think of it as real, you know? They would say things like, what if all of the satellites quit working and everybody realized that they were dependent on us? Or what if God sends a message and everybody realizes that they're dependent on us? And so now here we are with this worldwide pandemic. We're all very focused on supply lines. Sometimes we go to the grocery store and things we want are not there. And food has become intensely a part of the conversation in a way that it probably wasn't a year ago. And so it's very eerie for me and very, very, very uncomfortable. But it also makes me think, wow, these men that I was traveling with were very aware of the role that they played in society and the importance of their role. And there's a degree to which they just really wanted people to see and recognize the importance of what they were doing.
So how do you think these people would view the coronavirus stimulus payment system that's in place right now? Do you think they would eschew government help in this situation, or have you been in touch with them?
I have been in touch with them. I haven't asked them about this specific question. There are facets of what's going on with the virus that we have spoken about. It didn't occur to me to ask them about the payment system. Now, I can tell you that a number of the men who I traveled with were pretty conservative Mennonites, and some were old order Mennonites. So that's meaning that they dress what we call plain, although they use machinery. And some of those folks, I think, don't pay Social Security and therefore don't get Social Security payments.
They're very much off the grid, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, a lot of them are off the grid. So I think it would depend. They were much more vocal to me about the need to get the country back open again. And in certain conversations, there was not all of them, but there would be skepticism about the virus and whether the virus was real or not. The main character in this book is a guy named Eric, who is about 58. And Eric was a lifelong Republican, so the action in the book takes place in 2017, but in 2016, Eric saw the election happening, had traveled through the country. He was very concerned about Trump. And remember, in 2016, we didn't think that Trump could get elected. And Eric would talk to me and say, I'm really concerned that Trump is going to get elected. Like he had this presentiment that Trump would be the president based on the conversations he had with folks in the center of the country. And he himself didn't think that Trump should be the president. And so he, from the very beginning, has said to me, I think the virus is real. But it's been interesting listening to him talk to me about the way in which he has spoken to others to convey that the virus is a real phenomenon and that it's not something that's been hyped up by the media, or that it's not a way in which the Democratic Party is conspiring to bring down Trump. Like, he's conscious of the way that he presents those facts.
Yeah, the Mennonites really kind of have adapted in an interesting way. In one sense, they're anachronistic, but they live in the modern world in many ways.
I mean, there is a whole, I guess, a spectrum is really the right word, in the same way that there is in the Jewish community. You know, you have Reform Jews, and then you have conservative Jews, and then you have Hasidic Jews. And it's kind of similar to the way that the Mennonites live. Some live plain, some live what the old order Mennonites, who speak Pennsylvania Dutch, and there was one guy on our crew who was an Old Order Mennonite, and we would hear him at night on the Pennsylvania Dutch chat line talking to, you know, however many thousand Mennonites around the country. But then there are also Mennonites who are, who, you know, are educated in four-year universities and proficient in technology, etc. So I didn't know there was such a spectrum, but there is. And we did see Mennonite churches as we went across the United States, and I didn't know that, that such a thing existed either.
Singing songs for everyone. Sit beside a mountain stream, see her waters rise. Listen to the pretty sound of music as she flies. To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to the author of American Harvest, Marie Mutsky-Mockett. What did you learn about these migrant workers, these harvesters, in terms of their economic security? How do they get paid? I imagine it's a tough life.
Well, so for a harvest crew, they're paid every single day that they're on the road, and they're given three meals a day. Except on Sunday, they go get their own dinner. And so Eric goes on the road with his wife, Emily, and she does all the cooking, and she cooks three meals a day. Sometimes when we're working, actually frequently when we were working, she would pack up food in lunch boxes and drive it out to the field where everyone was working and serve them off the back of a Suburban, and then drive back to the trailer. I mean, it was really an amazing feat that she did. And there were many days where she would serve lunch like that and serve dinner like that. So she served food. And they had a washing machine. And so laundry, they could do their laundry. So they really didn't have expenses, I suppose, except for their own Wi-Fi if they had cell phones, although they couldn't use their cell phones during the work day. But they were paid, rain or shine, a wage every single day through the end of harvest. But there aren't a lot of people who make a living as a harvester. For most farming communities, it's almost like a rite of passage. People who are very bound to the land and to a farm think of the custom harvest experience as a chance to see the country and to see the United States and to travel through America. It's a very romantic thing that men will talk about, and older men will say, I remember when I was on the road, or I did this. So they don't tend to do it year after year after year.
In terms of our supply chain and our food right now, we're calling, for a good reason, a lot of these people who are not getting paid particularly well, grocery store clerks, checkers, shelf stockers, delivery truck drivers, we're calling them heroes. But I read a piece in The Atlantic that said, you know, we may call them heroes, but really they're victims. We call them heroes to justify their exploitation. Now, these harvesters are not exposed to the front lines of the coronavirus, but they're heroes in that same sense, in that we don't think of them. We don't think of how we get this flour delivered to our grocery stores.
Yeah, it was another writer who pointed out to me that so many of us are posting pictures on Instagram of the baking that we're doing during this type of sheltering.
Right.
And the baking comes from the flour. And it's really hard to get Very, very hard, a lot of hard data on the world of custom harvesting, because it's a very protective community. It's protective of itself, and it has its own culture, and it's pretty loyal to itself and doesn't want to be misunderstood. But Eric had said to me that he had once heard that 50% of U.S. wheat is cut by custom crews like his crew. And I think the statistic is that there are 350 custom harvest crews in the United States. So it's not a lot of people cutting a large percentage of the wheat that we have in the United States. And of course, the U.S. exports a lot of grain, but we do also consume of a lot of it within the United States. And I did put up a picture on Facebook the other day. The first crew has already headed out from Lancaster County to Texas. Two large semi-trucks hauling equipment, getting ready to set up to start cutting Texas wheat, which will ripen in May. And the thing about any crop is that when it's ready to be harvested, it has to be harvested. It's like a baby, you know, when the baby's ready to come, it comes. You can't.
Yeah, the virus doesn't wait for it.
No, and you
it doesn't wait for the virus.
Correct. And you can't schedule it either. And it was always really difficult for my friends. I would say, do you want to come to harvest? And they would say, well, when is it? And I would say, well, it'll be probably sometime in July, you know, but we live in a world where we schedule our meetings. You and I decided we were going to be speaking on the phone at this time for a particular amount of time. And we could arrange our days to make room for this time. Harvest doesn't work that way. The land really dictates the work that the men do, and the men have to arrange their days around what is happening on the ground. And even though a great deal of technology has affected the way that we farm, they still really have to follow the rhythm of the land and adjust their behavior accordingly. And that is how we get our food in this country. It's really pretty extraordinary to think about it. And I will also say, you know, one of the things that does make the United States amazing is that it can sustain its population. We do create enough calories for people to consume, which is really pretty remarkable.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm joined by author Marie Mutsky-Mockett, whose latest book is called American Harvest. So Marie, can you give us a little more detail into the actual harvesting in terms of how dangerous it is? You mentioned how there's a certain amount of crews that custom cut wheat. Do these crews also get to work in different grains? I'm curious.
They can.
And also in terms of when you say cutting, are they using heavy equipment, or how much is by hand, and do they own their own equipment, etc.?
These are all really great questions. The three major grains, wheat, corn, and soybeans, are planted on vast acres in the center of the country. And they are not harvested by hand. They are harvested by machine. My family farm at its peak was about 7,000 acres. And we would plant half of that every year. So let's say that there were roughly 3,200 acres of wheat planted every year. And if you think, Eric once said to me, most people can't visualize an acre. He said, so tell them that an acre is about the size of a football field. So you think of 3,200 football fields, it would be really nearly impossible to cut all of that by hand, right, in time before the rain came, or the wheat was no longer in such condition that you could harvest it. So we use machines, and the machine is the combine harvester, which is enormous, and really became popular, I think, at the end of the war, although there were versions of it that existed before World War II. And it's an incredible piece of engineering. There's the kind of the cabin, which is like a tractor, and then the header, which is a long knife, essentially. It's the part of the machine that actually goes in and severs the head of grain from the stalk. And these headers have gotten longer and therefore much more efficient over the years, even, you know, in the course of my lifetime. And They are incredibly sophisticated pieces of machinery, and they cost anywhere from $250,000 to $350,000 a piece. It's really hard for a farmer to necessarily buy that kind of equipment. There are other kinds of equipment that farmers need.
It's probably not feasible, right? If you're moving from farm to farm to be cruising around with your $300,000 harvest machine.
It's difficult. I mean, there are farmers, and we do meet a family in the book that owns its own machines. They're a Christian family, a farming family. So one of the daughters and her husband come out from Iowa to sort of join forces with the rest of the family in Nebraska. So they have three machines running at the same time. And that's a kind of thing that you can see that a lot. In farm country, the families will come together for harvest and put their machines together if they own their equipment. Other farmers like mine hire people like Eric who own their own equipment and every year have fresh equipment. But remember, each one of these things costs, like I said, you know, $250,000 to $350,000. So it's a lot of money to put into a piece of equipment that you use at harvest. And even though these things are, the construction is, they're made to be very durable, they break. And then when they break, most of the time they break when you're miles from town. So the same guys who drive the equipment like to be able to fix the equipment themselves. And you asked a question about how dangerous this is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's machinery that will kill you in an instant. And it can be incredibly dangerous, which is why these guys are so cautious. And it isn't just the combines, which are dangerous. There are tractors.
Thrashers.
So the thresher is inside the combine. It's called a combine harvester because it combines the cutting and the threshing.
Oh, I just know the thrashing from Neil Young's song, The Thrasher.
Yeah, that's dangerous too. And then the semi-trucks are, you know, it's all like really very heavy, very powerful equipment. You know, everyone has a story about someone who was killed by the equipment or a near miss. In the book, Eric tells the story of how his hand, just for a fraction of a second, got caught inside an auger, which is a large rotating metal screw that moves the wheat from the bin in the back of the combine into another location via, like...
They were hiding behind hay bales. They were planting in the full moon. They had given all they had for something new. But the light of day was on them. They could see the thrashers coming. And the water shone like diamonds in the dew. I was just getting up, hit the road before it's light. Trying to catch an hour on the sun. When I saw those thrashers rolling by, looking more than two lanes wide, I was feeling like my day had just begun.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to the author of American Harvest, Marie Mutsky-Mockett. After researching and learning more about the ins and outs of the wheat harvesting business, what kind of practices do you want to absorb into your own family's wheat farm in Nebraska, Marie?
So one of the things that I learned is when we say farming in the United States, it's definitely not a one-size-fits-all scenario. That, you know, sometimes people talk about monocultures and they say this pejoratively, and it's not really fair to speak of parts of the land that farm monocultures. It's not really fair to speak of that practice pejoratively. One of the reasons why, you know, the parts of the country that farm wheat, corn, and soy do so is because that is what the climate and the soil and perhaps most importantly, the water allow for that part of the country to grow. And actually, there is some greater variation in what is planted in the Great Plains than there was certainly when my father was a child. So I do explore that in the book because it's something I learned, and I think it is important for Americans to know. But one of the things that really promotes soil health is when we're able to rotate crops. And even if we're able to plant what's called a cover crop, and that's where a farmer will plant a crop in soil that has grown a cash crop, a crop that's sold for cash. You can grow what's called a cover crop that puts nutrients back into the soil, but that crop isn't necessarily harvested. And that's one of the ways in which we're able to protect soil, which is important for preventing the topsoil from blowing away, from the water running off into the waterways, etc. So I'm very interested in ways in which we can rotate crops on the land and perhaps even plant a topsoil. The problem with the part of the country where I have my farm is that moisture levels are incredibly low, and it's a lot easier to rotate crops and have different crops and plant cover crops if you have enough water to support many different crops. However, because we continue to breed plants that require less moisture, it is perhaps possible to grow a greater variety of crop. And that is something that I am interested in, and that will require the application of some science to farming. And that has convinced me that, you know, our knowledge of science should work hand in hand with agriculture to make for better practices that will in fact end up preserving the soil. And everything that I've said, I'm just saying really as a layman. I don't have the advanced technical knowledge that a true agronomist does.
But agronomists don't write as well as you, so.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I do hope our listeners get a chance to pick up a copy of American Harvest. Marie Mutsky-Mockett, thanks so much for being my guest on Z-Change Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I had such a good time talking to you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Clarence Gatemouth Brown, The Beatles, and Neil Young. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.